Good morning and welcome to Flight Logic Brief. It's Wednesday, June 17th, 2026. I'm Alex.
And I'm Sam. We've got a packed one today. Big regulatory news out of NetJets, a fatal business jet accident down in Texas we need to talk carefully about, and honestly, a bunch of fleet and ops stuff that's actually going to matter to how you fly this summer.
Yeah, it's one of those mornings where the headline isn't the loudest story, it's the most consequential one. So let's start there.
Let's do it. Source: Corporate Jet Investor.
So NetJets has gone to the Federal Aviation Administration and filed a formal petition for an exemption. This is docket FAA-2026-3840 if you want to go read it yourself. And what they're asking for is the ability to extend pilot duty hours on the Global 7500.
Okay, how far are we talking? Because duty time is the third rail of this whole industry.
So the flights in question are these ultra-long-range missions, 16 to 17 hours of flight time. And the proposal is four pilot crews with a maximum duty period of 21 hours.
21 hours. Wait, hold on. The exemption is from 14 CFR 135.269, right? That's the flight time and duty limitations under the charter rules.
That's exactly the section.
So here's why this is fascinating. The whole reason a four pilot crew exists is so you've got two augmenting pilots who can actually get real rest in the bunk while the other two fly. The aircraft, the BD-700-2A12, that's the Global 7500, it's got a proper crew rest setup. So in principle, the science supports it. But 21 hours of duty, that's the number that's going to get scrutiny.
And that's the tension, isn't it? Because on paper, augmented crew plus a fatigue risk management approach, that's been done at the airlines for years on the ultra-long haul routes.
Right. The airlines do this every single day to places like Singapore and Perth. But that's under Part 121 with a whole fatigue risk management system baked in. Bringing that framework into the Part 135 charter and fractional world, that's the precedent here. If NetJets gets this, every other large cabin operator is going to be lining up behind them.
So you think this is bigger than just NetJets?
Oh, 100%. This is the camel's nose. The Global 7500 and the 8000 can physically fly these missions nonstop now. The airframe can do it. But the regulation was written for a different era of business jet. The reg is the limiting factor, not the metal. So somebody had to be first to force the question. And of course, it's the biggest fractional operator on the planet.
And speaking of the metal being able to do it, there's a nice companion story here. Bombardier just delivered the first Global 8000 on the entire African continent.
To BUA Group, right? The Nigerian conglomerate?
BUA Group, yeah. Nigerian multinational. They're into cement, food, oil and gas, energy, infrastructure, real estate, basically everything. And they've now got the first Global 8000 in Africa.
That's a statement airplane. The 8000 is the fastest, longest-legged, purpose-built business jet out there, and it tells you something about where the demand is. The ultra-long-range market isn't just transatlantic finance guys anymore. You've got African industrial wealth that needs to connect Lagos or Abuja directly to London, to the Gulf, to Asia without a fuel stop.
And that connects right back to the duty time story, doesn't it? You sell people an airplane that can fly 17 hours nonstop.
And then the crew rules say you can't legally staff it for 17 hours nonstop. Exactly. The capability and the regulation are out of sync, and that gap is the whole NetJets petition in one sentence.
One more from the money side of the business. Global Jet Capital closed its ninth asset-backed securities offering. They're calling it BJETS 2026-1, and they raised about $659 million.
$659. And it's backed by what? Business aircraft loans and leases?
Loans and leases, structured across three tranches, and it pulled in 41 investors.
41 investors is the number I'd flag there. That's a deep, liquid market for business aviation debt. 3 or 4 years ago, people were nervous about where private aviation demand would settle after the pandemic boom. A securitization that size, that oversubscribed, tells you the institutional money still believes the asset class holds value, which, for those of us actually flying these airplanes, is good news. It means fleets keep getting financed and renewed.
Stable financing, stable jobs.
That's the through line, yeah. Force Google News.
All right. We need to shift to a harder story, and we're going to handle it with care because details are still developing and the reporting right now is thin.
Yeah, this is the Texas one.
This is Laredo, Texas, today. A business jet came down on a highway, caught fire, and at least one person is dead with multiple others injured. This is being reported across basically every major outlet, Fox News, the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, the Indian Express, and the local reporting points to it being near Loop 20, with Laredo International Airport shut down.
So Loop 20 and the airport closure, that's the detail that tells you this was almost certainly a terminal area event, either shortly after departure or on the approach. That's the most dangerous phase of any flight.
And I want to be really clear with our listeners. We do not have a confirmed aircraft type. We don't have a cause. We don't have a number of occupants confirmed. The Google News feeds we're seeing are headline snippets, not full reporting yet.
And that's important, because in the first 24 hours after an accident, the worst thing we can do as a profession is speculate on cause. There was even a Reddit thread floating around tagging it as a NetJets flight, a dashcam clip, but that is completely unverified, and we should not be repeating it as fact.
Right. We're flagging that that rumor exists precisely so people don't run with it.
Exactly. What we can talk about responsibly is the thing this accident illustrates, which is the catastrophic potential of an off-airport impact with a turbine aircraft. When you put one of these down on a populated road, you've got jet fuel, you've got post-impact fire, you've got bystanders and vehicles. The footage reportedly shows first responders rushing in.
And that emergency response piece is worth dwelling on for a second.
It really is. Because for those of us flying, the lesson isn't ghoulish, it's practical. The survivability of an accident like this often comes down to two things. One, occupant restraint and brace. Did people have their belts on? Were they secured? And two, how fast egress happens before fire spreads. The window is measured in seconds, not minutes.
Which is why we brief it every single leg, even when it feels routine.
Every leg. The day you skip the passenger brief because it's a quick hop with people you know, that's the day it matters. The National Transportation Safety Board will be on this, the FAA will be on this, and we'll bring you the factual findings as they come out, not the rumors.
Our thoughts are with everyone affected down in Laredo. We'll stay on it.
Yeah.
On a much lighter note from that same feed, and a useful palate cleanser, there was a piece going around called When Business Jet Buyers Make Costly Errors.
Oh, this is a good one. And it's relevant to a lot of our listeners who fly for owners or are advising them.
So the gist is that acquisition mistakes are some of the most expensive missteps in all of corporate aviation. We're talking hundreds of thousands of dollars on the line during the purchase process.
And the errors are almost always the same ones. People fall in love with the airplane and skimp on the pre-buy inspection. Or they don't understand the maintenance history, the damage history, whether the engines are on a program or off program.
That engine program thing is huge.
It's enormous. An airframe that's off the engine maintenance program can be a 6 or 7 figure swing in value, and a buyer who doesn't know to ask will get crushed at the next major inspection. The other classic is import and registration surprises, especially with cross-border deals. As a crew, if you're being asked to go fly a newly acquired airplane, ask whether a thorough pre-buy actually happened. Your name's going in the logbook.
Protect yourself.
Always.
That's a nice bridge, actually, into something operational from the National Business Aviation Association. They put out guidance on best practices for safe quick turns.
Quick turns. The thing every charter and fractional pilot does 5 times a day and nobody trains formally.
So the headline recommendation is that the coordination needs to start early. They're saying communication between the flight crew and the fixed base operator, the FBO, should begin 10 to 15 minutes before arrival.
10 to 15 minutes out, yes. And that number sounds obvious until you realize how often it doesn't happen. You're busy, you're running the approach, and the call to the FBO becomes an afterthought.
So what does that early call actually buy you?
It buys you staging. If you call 10 minutes out and say, I need 2,000 pounds of fuel, a lav service, 2 cases of water, and I've got a passenger in a wheelchair, the FBO can have all of that on the ramp ready to go when you set the brake. If you wait until you're shut down to ask, now you're sitting there for 40 minutes and your quick turn is dead.
And the NBAA piece specifically called out maintenance oversight too.
That's the part I really like that they included, because here's the trap with quick turns. Time pressure compresses your margin for error across every single task at once. You're rushing the fuel, you're rushing the walk around, you're rushing the weight and balance. And the walk around is exactly where a rushed crew misses a fuel cap, misses a tire, misses a ground service panel left open.
So the pressure itself is the hazard.
The pressure is the hazard. That's the whole insight. A quick turn is one of the highest risk operational phases precisely because it feels low risk. It's routine, it's on the ground, what could go wrong? And the answer is, you skip a step because you're hurrying, and that step bites you at rotation.
So the fix is, plan it like you'd plan anything else.
Plan it, brief it, and protect the walk around. Don't let the clock rush the one inspection that catches the stuff that kills you. If you need an extra 5 minutes, take the 5 minutes.
Good practical stuff, source Simple Flying. Let's open it up to the wider airline and industry world because there's a lot moving. First one, and it's a bit of a fight. Ryanair is going after the European Union over cabin bags.
Of course they are.
So the EU is pushing new rules requiring airlines to provide a free cabin bag to every passenger. And Ryanair's chief executive is calling it, quote, regulatory nonsense.
And look, you can roll your eyes at Ryanair, but their argument has internal logic. Their entire business model is the unbundled fare. The base ticket is stripped to nothing and you pay for everything on top. If you mandate that a cabin bag is included, they say, fine, we'll just raise the base fare for everyone, including the people traveling with nothing.
So the people who pack light end up subsidizing the people who don't.
That's their claim, yeah. It's the classic tension between consumer protection regulation and the ultra-low-cost model. I don't have a dog in that fight, but operationally, free cabin bags for all means more bags in the cabin, more gate checking, slower boarding, slower turns. There's a real ops cost, not just a fare cost.
Speaking of regulators making decisions, the U.S. Department of Transportation has been busy. Two big ones. Riyadh Air got approval to fly to the United States.
That's a milestone for them. Riyadh Air is the Saudi startup, and DOT approval to operate between Saudi Arabia and the U.S., that's one of the last big regulatory gates for launching their international long-haul network. They'll be flying the 787-9 on it.
Brand new carrier, wide-body, transatlantic, and beyond. That's ambitious.
Hugely ambitious. And it fits the pattern of the Gulf carriers using geographic position to connect everything to everything. Watch the slot and gateway choices. That'll tell you who they're really targeting.
And the second DOT story, Delta is off the hook on the CrowdStrike mess.
Oh, this one I've been waiting on. So you remember July 2024, the CrowdStrike software outage that just detonated Delta's operation for days, thousands of cancellations.
How could anyone forget? So DOT ran a nearly two-year investigation, and they've now closed it without major fines.
And the reasoning is what matters. DOT concluded that Delta sufficiently supported the affected passengers, the refunds, the rebooking, the reimbursements. So no big enforcement action. That's actually a meaningful signal to every airline. It says, if you take care of stranded passengers properly, when things blow up, the regulator will give you credit for it. The penalty's not automatic.
Carrot and stick.
And in this case, the carrot for doing right by people. I'll take it.
Let's talk metal. There's a fascinating and slightly alarming one here. Some carriers are stripping perfectly good Airbus A321neos for parts.
Okay, this is the one that genuinely makes my jaw drop, and it's all about the engines.
The Pratt & Whitney geared turbofan issue.
The PW1000G, the geared turbofan. The durability problems on that engine, particularly a powder metal contamination issue in some of the high-pressure components, have grounded huge numbers of these jets waiting for parts and shop visits. And the engine shortage has gotten so severe that it is now economically rational, get this, to take a nearly new A321neo airframe and pull the engines off it to keep two other airplanes flying.
Wait, they're parting out brand new airframes just to harvest the engines?
Brand new. The airframe might have very low hours, perfectly good, and it's worth more disassembled because the engines are worth more in someone else's wing than the whole airplane is sitting on the ground. That is an upside-down situation that, 5 years ago, you would have said is impossible.
That tells you how desperate the engine supply situation really is.
It's the single biggest narrow-body headache in the industry right now. Airlines have dozens of jets parked. So when you see an A321neo get cannibalized, that's not waste, that's triage.
On the production side, though, Airbus is going the other direction. They just opened their 10th A320 final assembly line.
And the location is poetic. It's in Toulouse, in the Jean-Luc Lagardère complex. That building was originally built to assemble the A380.
The Super Jumbo's old house is now cranking out narrow bodies.
Which is the entire story of the last 20 years of commercial aviation in one building. The four-engine, double-decker, giant hub dream is dead. And the future is the efficient single-aisle flown point-to-point. They literally repurposed the cathedral of the A380 to build A320s. 10th assembly line, they cannot build them fast enough.
Demand is just relentless.
Relentless. And it loops right back to the engine story, by the way. They can build airframes all day. The constraint is engines.
A couple of nicer passenger experience items from this batch. KLM unveiled its first ever Airbus A350-900.
And they named it beautifully, the Night Watch, after the Rembrandt painting.
Deliveries expected end of August, commercial flights starting in September. And it's the first time KLM has operated the type at all.
That's the headline for the ops, folks. A brand new type entering a fleet means new training, new procedures, new everything for KLM's pilots and engineers. It's a big deal internally, even if the passengers just see a pretty livery and a Rembrandt name.
And Emirates is reconfiguring its A380s, the differences between first and business class on the Super Jumbo in 2026.
Emirates is mid-retrofit on a multi-billion dollar cabin program, and they've taken some of the old two-class A380s and added the premium cabins back in. The gap between their first class and business class is just enormous. The showers, the suites up front. But the real story is they're investing heavily to keep the A380 relevant for another decade plus while everyone else retires theirs.
They're the last true believers in the Super Jumbo.
The last believers, and they're betting big.
Two crew-focused ones to round out this group. First, there was a piece on how cabin crew rest and sleep on the A350-1000.
And this is genuinely interesting engineering. The -1000 has hidden crew rest compartments you get to via stairs in the rear galley, tucked above or below the main cabin, so they don't eat into revenue space.
Bunks you'd never know are there as a passenger.
Never. And it ties directly back to where we started the show. This is the airline world solution to exactly the fatigue problem NetJets is trying to solve in the business jet world. Crew rest is the enabling technology for ultra long haul. No bunks, no 17-hour leg. It's that simple.
Everything connects today.
It really does.
And last in this group, a fun comparison. How U.S. fighter pilot salaries stack up against other leading nations in 2026.
So the bottom line is American fighter pilots come out on top of the four countries they looked at. Entry level somewhere around $50,000 to $60,000, and senior officers up around $110,000 to $142,000 in base pay.
But base pay isn't the whole picture.
No, and that's the key. On top of base, you've got flight pay, housing allowances, and increasingly aviation retention bonuses because the military is fighting the same pilot poaching war the airlines created. A senior fighter pilot's total compensation is well north of the base number. But here's the thing. It still doesn't touch what that same pilot can make at a major airline, which is exactly why retention bonuses exist in the first place.
The pull of the left seat at a legacy carrier.
It's gravity. You can't fight it. You can only pay to slow it down, source the air current.
Speaking of the military, the Air Current has a really thoughtful piece on how the age of drone warfare is creating new battlefield roles for helicopters.
This is a smart one. So the Pentagon is increasingly using helicopters as counter-drone platforms.
Helicopters shooting down drones.
Right, and it sounds backwards at first because we've spent a few years now watching cheap drones be incredibly lethal and cost-effective against expensive hardware. The lesson from conflicts around the globe is that a few thousand-dollar drone can kill a multi-million dollar vehicle.
So how does a helicopter fit into countering that?
Because a helicopter can get to altitude and speed, carry sensors and guns, and engage a slow-moving small drone in a way a ground unit struggles to. And the article notes U.S. Air Force reservists starting a role in this around June 22nd. So this is active, near-term doctrine, not theory.
It's a reinvention of what the helicopter is for.
Totally. For decades, the attack helicopter's job was tank killing and close air support. Now part of the mission is air-to-air against uncrewed systems. That's a genuine doctrinal shift, and it'll drive new training and new sensor fits. The drone changed everything. And now the helicopter is adapting to hunt the thing that was supposed to make it obsolete.
Fascinating stuff. We've got a few from the video side, and unfortunately, a couple of these are heavy. The big one? A B-52 crashed at Edwards Air Force Base in California.
Yeah, this is a tragedy. June 15th, a B-52H went down at Edwards, and all eight people on board were killed.
Eight souls. And the reporting indicates six were Air Force service members and two were Boeing employees.
The two Boeing employees is the detail that tells you what this airplane was probably doing. Edwards is the Air Force's flight test center. A crew makeup like that, mixed military and manufacturer, strongly suggests this was a test or evaluation flight, not a routine operational sortie.
Which matters for understanding it.
It matters enormously. And it also reminds you that flight test, even on an airframe as old and proven as the B-52, is inherently high-risk work. These crews push airplanes into corners of the envelope the rest of us never go. We don't have a cause, and again, we shouldn't guess. But 8 people, including the folks who helped build and modernize that fleet, that's a brutal loss for both the Air Force and the Boeing community.
And the timing is poignant, because the B-52 is in the middle of a massive re-engineering and modernization program meant to fly it into the 2030s and beyond.
Right. The goal is a 100-year bomber, so test work on that jet is constant right now. Our condolences to everyone involved.
The second video item is one where the real lesson is about misinformation. The death of the musician Oliver Tree in a helicopter crash.
So the facts as reported, a mid-air collision between 2 helicopters over Brazil killed Oliver Tree, who was 32, along with 5 other people, 6 total.
And the misinformation angle?
This is the part worth our attention. A viral video went around that news outlets and social media accounts shared claiming to show the crash, and it actually showed a completely different, unrelated event. So one of the most widely circulated aviation accidents recently is also one of the most misreported.
Which is the exact same caution we raised on Laredo this morning.
It's the bookend, isn't it? In the first hours after any accident, the footage going viral is frequently the wrong footage. Old crashes, unrelated incidents, simulator clips. If you're a professional in this field, treat early viral video with deep suspicion. Wait for the verified investigation.
Discipline in what we believe, not just what we fly.
Exactly that.
And to end the video block on something genuinely delightful, because we need it, there's a great feature on a rare Antonov An-2 biplane.
Oh, I love the An-2. Tell me.
So a gentleman named Douglas Fulton out of Valdez, Alaska, owns a PZL-built Antonov An-2. His is a 1988 airframe. The design itself goes back to 1947, Soviet origin, built as a crop sprayer and a military jump plane.
And it's the largest single-engine biplane ever mass-produced. It's this gigantic, fabric-covered radial engine beast. And here's the party trick everybody loves. The published flight manual essentially has no stall speed listed.
No stall speed?
The story goes that if the engine quits, the airplane will parachute down under full control at something like a fast walking pace. You can just about hover it into a headwind. For Alaska bush flying, where short, rough strips are the whole game, an airplane that lands at a crawl and hauls a ton of cargo is perfect. It's the right airplane for that environment 70-some years after it was designed.
Soviet engineering that outlived the Soviet Union.
Outlived the empire and is still working in Alaska. I love it.
Let's bring it home with the pilot community, the ARPA Our Flying World on Reddit, where the real day-to-day texture of this job lives. And there's a lot of training and check ride talk this week.
There always is, and honestly, these are the threads I find most valuable, because it's the unfiltered reality.
A couple of tough ones. One pilot wrote in pretty raw, said they've had 2 commercial pilot license check ride failures, and they're wondering if they're cut out for this. International student started in the U.S. back in February 2025, dealt with months of scheduling delays, examiner unavailability, instructor changes.
And I want to speak directly to that person and anyone in that spot. The thing that jumps out at me there isn't a skill failure. It's a systemic one. Examiner unavailability, instructor turnover, scheduling chaos. Those aren't your fault, and they absolutely degrade your readiness. You can't perform consistently when the training pipeline around you is broken.
So 2 failures doesn't mean what it feels like it means.
It does not. Half the people in airline seats right now have a bust or 2 in their logbook. What matters is what you do after. And there was a related thread. Somebody failed their Part 141 instrument stage 2 check, said it was the first failure of their life, felt like their perfect record was ruined, and they're worried about applying to the airlines.
That's such a common fear.
And here's the honest answer. The airlines do not expect a spotless record. They expect honesty about your failures and evidence that you learned from them. A stage check bust on VOR navigation and partial panel holds, which is what that one was, that's a fixable knowledge gap, not a character flaw. The interview question isn't, did you ever fail? It's what happened and what did you change?
On the partial panel point, that one's interesting because it's a training philosophy thing.
It really is. We've built this GPS-centric training world, and rightly so. The Magenta Line is fantastic. But these stage checks still test raw VOR work and partial panel because the day your gear fails is the day you need it. So if you're a primary student listening, don't treat partial panel and raw data nav as a checkbox. That's the stuff that saves you.
There was also a multi-engine add-on failure that's a great teaching moment.
Oh, the engine shutdown one. Yeah. The candidate failed the multi-add-on because, in their own words, they shut the engine down above 3,000 feet AGL instead of troubleshooting. And that is a textbook checkride bust, but it's an important one. The Airman certification standards lay out a sequence. When you get a simulated failure at altitude, you identify, you verify, you troubleshoot, and only then, if appropriate, do you secure the engine. Jumping straight to shutting it down skips the steps that, in the real world, might have actually restored the engine.
The reflex to just feather and secure.
Right. And it's a natural panic reflex, but it's exactly backwards. Slow down, work the flow. An engine that's still making some power is your friend. Don't kill it before you've diagnosed it.
Let's lighten the training talk with the perennial money question. There was a detailed, very candid write-up from a current CFI student at ATP Flight School.
And this is the number that always stops people. They put the cost at $128,000 and up, with financing at a 13% annual rate.
13% APR.
13% on a six-figure loan. And to be fair to the poster, they said good things too: fast-paced, quality resources, high checkride pass rates. The accelerated model works for a lot of people, but you've got to go in with eyes open about the debt load. That's a mortgage-sized loan at credit card adjacent interest, and you're carrying it on a first officer salary.
So is it worth it?
It can be if you finish fast and get to the right-hand seat of a regional quickly, the math eventually works. But the structure rewards speed. Every extra month you spend not flying the line is interest piling up. Just know what you're signing.
A practical one, a lot of working pilots will relate to. Somebody asked about getting a high-performance endorsement for a summer job flying a Cessna 182 and whether they could knock it out in an approved simulator instead of the actual airplane.
So the high-performance endorsement, that's under 14 CFR 61.31, required for any airplane with more than 200 horsepower. And it's one of the simpler endorsements out there. No minimum hours, just ground and flight training and a logbook sign-off.
Can you do it in the sim?
In a properly qualified flight training device with an instructor, you can do training toward it, but for an endorsement like this, most people just do it in the airplane because it's quick, and the 182 is benign. Honestly, for a 182, it's an afternoon of work. The real value isn't the paperwork, it's actually learning the constant speed prop and the cowl flaps and the systems before you're out there doing it for money.
Don't treat the endorsement as the goal. Treat the competence as the goal.
Every time.
Couple of fun community sightings to close out, because Reddit isn't all checkride anxiety. There was a great spot of a Navy E-6B Mercury doing pattern work at Dyess Air Force Base in Abilene, Texas, flying alongside three C-130s.
And that's a cool catch, because the E-6B is a rare bird to see in the pattern. It's the Navy's Airborne Command Post, the TACAMO mission, the airplane that maintains communication with the ballistic missile submarine fleet. It's a heavily modified 707 airframe. Seeing one shooting touch-and-goes next to Air Force C-130s is a neat little bit of Joint Ops Americana.
And in the rotorcraft department, somebody had an MH-47G buzzing their neighborhood for 8 hours straight.
8 hours, that poor neighborhood. The MH-47G is the Special Operations Chinook, flown by the 160th Special Operations Aviation Regiment, the Night Stalkers. So if one's orbiting your house all day, that's almost certainly training, not an exercise you want to read too much into. But 8 hours of tandem rotor thump is a lot of ibuprofen.
And tying back to where we began the program, there was even a Reddit post about a DC 1030 fire bomber working a fire.
Yeah, somebody's town had a significant fire, lost 5 houses sadly, but the forward progress got stopped, and there was a DC-10 very large air tanker working it. And that's the modern reality of aerial firefighting. These big converted airliners, the DC-10s, dropping enormous loads of retardant. As fire seasons get worse and fires push right into towns, those heavy tankers are doing more and more of the heavy lifting.
Old airframes, new missions, which has kind of been the theme of the whole show.
It really has. A 380 plants building. A320s, helicopters hunting drones, B-52s flying to 100 years old, DC-10s fighting fires, everything getting repurposed.
All right, that's going to do it for us this morning. Big picture, keep an eye on that NetJets duty time petition, docket FAA 2026-3840, because where that lands is going to shape ultra-long-range flying for years.
And we'll be tracking the Laredo investigation and the Edwards B-52 test crash as the verified facts come out. No rumors, just findings. take care of each other out there.
Brief your passengers, protect your walk around on those quick turns, and we'll see you tomorrow.
Fly safe, everybody.
This has been Flight Logic Brief. I'm Alex.
And I'm Sam. So long.